Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 550 with my guest, Catherine Hahn. This is a replay of an interview that was originally aired in 2011, and I really, really like this interview a lot. This is my last week of vacation, so we will be back next week with a brand new episode. We are sponsored this week, as always, by BetterHelp.com, online therapy. I enjoy crying in my recliner. Got a nice little box of Kleenex right there. I don't have to get in the car. BetterHelp has a ton of great qualified therapists. They're licensed in all 50 states. Their interface is easy to use, and I'm a big fan. Been doing it for years. So if you're interested, go to betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash metal part so they know you came from this podcast, and then just fill out a questionnaire, and if they have a provider that they feel is a good fit for you, they'll match you up with a counselor, and then you can experience a free week of counseling to see if it's your thing, and you need to be over 18. And here now is that replay of the interview with Catherine Hahn from 2011. Welcome to episode 83 with my guest, Catherine Hahn. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, an hour of honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. It's not a doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room that hopefully doesn't suck. I'm not a doctor, but I am a hypochondriac. The website for this show is mentalpod.com. That's also the Twitter name you can follow me at, if you'd be so kind as to do that. And please go check out the website. There's all kinds of good stuff there. You can sign up for the newsletter. You can post in the forum. There's about a half a dozen different surveys you can take. I've got a new one up about how have you responded in the past to sexual advances being made on you. So if you go and take that one, I would greatly appreciate it. I wanted to mention about the interview with Catherine Hahn. There was a couple of areas of the interview that we kind of went into she requested that I keep private. So if it seems like there are some things that you're like, why is Paul not following up on that? It's for that reason, but I don't think any of it is necessarily pertinent to what the interview that ultimately you will hear. I'm very happy in its completeness, and really, really enjoyed doing it and really enjoyed meeting her. I want to plug something that a friend of mine has. I have a friend named Rich who has been working his ass off trying to get this product marketed that he invented. And I believe he did it with another person as well. And when he told me what the idea was, I was like, I think people should know about that. And he's not paying me any money to mention this. I just think you guys should check it out. He created this. It's a workout towel that is, it's made of bamboo thread, and it's super soft. It's called Zhu, Z-H-U, which is Chinese for bamboo. And what it is it's a workout towel that is made of bamboo fibers that have been spun. So it's like cotton. It's super soft. It's super absorbent. And because it's bamboo, it's naturally antibacterial. And bamboo is very, very sustainable. And here's the really cool thing about this, this towel is at one end of it are zippered pockets. So when you're working out, you can keep your, you know, smartphone, your keys, whatever, with you. And, I just think it's a great idea, and he gave me one, and I love it. So if you want to buy one, go to getzoo.com. And again, Zhu is spelled Z-H-U. And, I just think it's a great idea. So, how did I want to, I want to kick things off with an email that I got. This is from a guy named Matt, who is a vet, and he wrote this about coming home. And I'll post this on the website if you want to go there and read it as well. And he opens it with a quote from General Patton that says, "The object of war isn't to die for your country, but to make that other poor bastard die for his." And then he writes, "I remember when I decided to join the military. It wasn't for college money or to see the world or to shoot someone. I didn't think of any of that. When I joined, I did it to protect my country, my people, and my friends. I saw the planes flying into the buildings when I was in high school, and I remember feeling in my stomach that I was going to go. I've always had a problem trusting people in my life, and I wasn't going to start with a bunch of young kids holding guns. When I talked to my recruiter, I told her, I want to be the hardest, meanest, best soldier I can be. I want to be face-to-face with evildoers. She quickly signed me up for special operations and gave me a date to leave. The day I left, she drove me to my MEPS, M-E-P-S, I forget what that, he told me what that is, an abbreviation for it, I forget. It's an entrance, exam that you take. The day I left, she drove me to my MEPS and told me, have fun now, cause when you come home, everything will be different. I didn't know what she meant, but I was too worried about basic and leaving my friends. I went through basic with ease, but the next year and a half of special operations training was hell. Nothing about it is easy, and they made sure of that. I won't even start to tell you the ways they tortured us, but it was all worth it to protect my people, friends, and country. I was deployed many times and saw my share of combat against the evildoers. I would have stayed in until I died, but after 5 years and a hand injury, I was released from special operations. I remember the day I knew I didn't fit into society anymore. I went to a party with some new friends because the friends I had before I was in the army didn't like me anymore. I wasn't on their level of partying, and I had deep thoughts about how to make this world better. They didn't want to hear that when they're drunk and high. They want to laugh. Problem was that they were in a state of mind continually, so when would they think about it? At this party, there was a man pushing around a woman violently, but everyone just watched. No way was I going to, so I called the man out. I told him if he hit her again that I'd break his hand. By this point, everyone was watching, but not one person stood with me. The man tried to hit me, and I broke his fucking hand, just like I promised. The girl who I stood up for called the police and tried to put me in jail. The policeman let me go and told me, that's why you mind your own business. I wanted to scream at the top of my lungs that I'm no coward and I won't stop helping when I see it's needed. I knew then that I wasn't like everyone else anymore. Everything has changed. I've seen my share of horrible, and I wasn't going to let it happen around me. Even if I'm the only one standing, I'll still stand. I remember the day I figured out it was all bullshit. This took about a year after I came home, but this one hit harder than anything else. I worked as a special education paraprofessional. I only took the job because I thought it would help my karma balance out. I was going through a lot, thinking about what I did to other humans in the name of my country, my people, and my friends. a country that wouldn't help me find my way or give me disability for my aching hand, the people who wouldn't stand by me when they saw injustice, the friends who didn't even want to give me a chance when I came home. I broke down, spent a week in bed crying and broke, wondering why I did any of it. I wanted to die. No question in my mind that I would have ended it if I had had the right tools. Luckily, I didn't. I quit my job, but had to have some income, so I started looking into construction. That's when I finally put it all together. I looked at the customer's bill, which was $12,000. I was paid $120 for that job. 1%. That's all I made for doing 25% of the work. Well, I brought this fact up to my boss and was quickly released. Now I sit here unemployed, beaten up by the way things are, but not broken anymore. I had my time for that, and the time has passed. My quest now is a different one. I want to educate the people about what we've allowed to take control of our country and our military. Our government is just a puppet to money and greed. It used me, and it will use you if it can. Big business has not only destroyed our country, it has used the people's good intentions to do horrible things. We give up our rights daily when we go to jobs that underpay and deal with bosses who treat us horribly. The hardest part about coming home wasn't losing my friends or seeing a man beat up that woman. It wasn't the thought that I killed men for no reason other than to make a rich man more wealthy. It was seeing my fellow humans not stand by my side to stop something that we all knew was wrong. It's watching my fellow Americans go to shit jobs and get treated like shit and not stand up for themselves. I'm not saying take a gun to work. I'm saying be mentally strong and say it, enough is enough, and I won't be a part of this war machine or a part of making the rich richer. Demand respect. And Matt, I want to thank you for writing that, and I want to also add that I'm not trying to politicize things by reading that. That is just one soldier's take on returning home. And I felt like he needed his voice to be heard. And so that is why I read that.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I want to read one more thing, and this because this guy, the survey that I'm reading, just touched me. This guy calls himself Fiddle Butt. He is bisexual. He's in his 20s. Was raised in an environment that's a little bit dysfunctional. Never been sexually abused. Deepest, darkest thoughts. He writes, every time I see some show like The Office or Parks and Recreation trying to make me sympathize with desk jockeys getting played to play solitaire, my blood pressure spikes. I work in a warehouse running my ass off, working lots of weekends, and always getting asked to put in even more hours, and I still don't even make enough money to move out of the house. Fuck you. I'd stab myself in the thigh to get a job where I could sit on my ass and instant message my friends all day. I wish I could fuck my thoughts into their heads. What sexual fantasies are most powerful to you? He writes, I want to be dominated by a woman much taller and bigger than me, bordering on inhuman, like 7 or 8 feet tall. Sometimes I imagine her being firm and muscular. Other times she's fat with a soft, squeezable belly. I want her to lie on top of me and hold me by the wrists and cover me up with her body. Sorry if I'm going into too much detail here. That's okay. We welcome detail on the surveys. I encourage people to, not for, you know, the sake of gratuity. I don't want people to fill out pornography on the, I don't want it to be erotic fiction, but I want what it is that that you are thinking and feeling to come across, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Continuing with what he wrote, he says, other times I fantasize about cross-dressing in a public place, then getting caught and being, quote, punished by another man. Would you ever consider telling a partner or close friend your fantasies? He writes, I'd certainly tell people the first one, but probably not the second, mostly because I'm still not entirely sure of my sexuality. I've never been in a relationship with another man, but my mind has no problem with thinking about cocks or attractive male bodies. Deepest, darkest secrets, he writes, I spend almost all of my free time at home. I feel like I'm incapable of just going outside and being around strangers and talking to them. If I ever took a vacation, I'd probably just lay around at home, surf the internet, masturbate 8 times a day, and get irresponsibly drunk. Do these secrets and thoughts generate any particular feelings towards yourself? He writes, I feel like an incomplete person for being so incapable of meeting people. I don't even know where to start. Sometimes I'll do things like go to a greasy spoon diner and just eat by myself with a book just to be out of the house for an hour or two. The last refuge of the shut-in and denial, so I can tell myself, well, at least I did something before I go to bed. And then the last thing that he writes, do you have any comments to make the mental illness happy hour better? He wrote, give me $10.
Everybody, yeah. I know is bizarrely, beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
I couldn't stand you in the audition.
I couldn't stand you.
Yes, yeah. Awful. Yeah. I was drunk.
And I learned that I could solve my problems.
And said.
Through violence, since I couldn't communicate.
Lonely?
Yes. I'm afraid that my genitalia is ugly.
That's hurtful.
And what was your role in the robbery?
I mean, you never knew what you were going home to.
I had a jar that had teeth in it.
I was a wreck.
Other people's teeth?
Yeah.
I'm here with Catherine... God damn you.
God damn it, I'm sorry.
No, fuck it. I'm just going to pack my shit up and leave. I'm here with Catherine Hahn. I'm at her house in Los Angeles, and I'm so excited we finally made this happen. We've been emailing back and forth. You don't know me from Adam. You're a friend of Jamie Denbo's, who was kind enough to agree to come do this podcast.
Oh, I'm excited to be here. Are you kidding me? Half a year later.
Looking at her couch, and her kids had started to draw on the couch, and you said, fuck it.
And we were like, fuck it. Well, what happened is I spent all this money getting it cleaned. It's like a white couch. And it was like, stay away from the couch. You have two little kids. And then I sat down on it and promptly just like bled all the way through. I totally got my period on the couch. So after that, I was like, oh, fuck it. Let's get out the markers.
So there's all these kids' drawings all over it, and it's so awesome.
Period blood. That's underneath, though. We flipped the cushions, so you don't have to see that. Anyway.
Well, I guess there won't be any question about whether or not it'll be hard to get you to open up on the podcast. People probably know Catherine best from, I know you best from Step Brothers, which I think is such an underrated movie. I've watched it like 5 times, and you are so fucking funny in that. She plays this emotionally abused, would it be fair to call your character a nymphomaniac?
Yeah, I think so.
Who just kind of falls in love with John C. Reilly.
Obsessively puts it all on this innocent man, all of her unhappiness.
Oh, it's... Yeah. The you have to rent it. People would also know you from Anchorman. They would know you from name some other things biggest things that people would know you from. Crossing Jordan? Were you on Crossing Jordan?
I was on a television program called Crossing Jordan, a different milieu. Yeah, I was the grief counselor in the morgue. So that was fascinating.
Well, you're a smarty pants who studied acting at Northwestern University and then went to the Yale School of Drama. Is that correct?
Yes.
Smarty pants.
And boo-hoo haven, a lot of student debt. It was not so smart to go into a career in this business and accrue as much student debt as if I was studying to be a doctor.
but you've paid it off now.
I've gotten to pay it off. Barely. Yeah. Thank God.
Do you ever get to do your, I suppose Crossing Jordan was where you could kind of use your drama skills?
I don't know. I mean, like, it's so interesting because I never, you know, got into this as a comedian. Like, I was always, I mean, I come from pretty funny stock. Like, we're pretty tough on each other. There's a lot of laughing going on in my house growing up. just a lot of ribbing of each other. But we, I always just wanted to be an actor. Starting with, I think I went to Catholic school and I was Salty the Psalm Book with a P.S. P.S.A.L.T.Y. That's my first on stage performances. I fucking loved it so much. I just love the, I love the like community. Like I love the little world.
It is its own kind of world, yeah. And the collaboration and the little community when you're doing a play.
I love the first day of rehearsal. Like I love the sharpened pencils. I love the script. I love like getting, I love the like tech rehearsals. They call them like 10 out of 12, which is like 10 hours out of 12. But you always feel like you're like in the, like, I love the first day of costumes. I just fell so in love with it. So I never like went into it as wanting to be a comedian or even an improviser. Like I would never call myself that because I feel like the people that are, it's such a gorgeous, beautiful, pure skill. And the people that have like devoted so much of their lives to learning that, I'm like, I'm so humbled by and so, you know, in awe of.
I got to interview Gene Wilder.
Are you kidding me?
I swear to God. Yeah. It was at a Sketchfest up in San Francisco, and I was lucky enough to get to go out to dinner with him.
Oh my God. Night,
and sit next to him and have dinner, and he said the exact same thing that you say. He did not consider himself to be funny. He considered himself to be an actor, and I think that's why you guys are so funny, is because you play the truth of the moment.
I hope so. Yeah, I think, I mean, I mean, I feel like also if I'm rooted in the something that's the given, like if I know who I am, if I have a POV, then it's easier to improvise that way. Like, I mean, the worst is to go in and just, I mean, the, you know, some people would feel like that's a gorgeous challenge, but it's always harder for me when it's like from literally nothing. Like if I know who I am, then it's easier to go in, you know, I like a costume. I like a funny nose. I like, you know, all of that business, you know. And when that happens, then it's easier to improvise in scene, I think. But yeah, I'm just in awe of it. I'm in awe of comedians. Like I'm just really am. Like stand up is just, I just am in awe. Like I really am. Like it's the most terrifying thing to me to think of that.
You have to really feel a need in your bones to do it, because it is kind of insane to say, I'm going to have all these people quiet down.
Yeah,
and I'm going to go up there and justify them paying $12. I'm
sitting in the dark. Yeah. Tell me something new.
Yeah.
Let me see something in a new. It's like awe inspiring. And even when it doesn't work, you're just like, oh man, it's like it's just beautiful to me. Like it just kills me. I love it.
But the desperation underneath it, yes. You would not be in awe of. Because I think that's what the desperate need to be heard.
To be heard, of course.
Yeah. But let's talk about, you know, what I know about you so far is you're a super nice person and apologies flow out of you like your period blood.
Exactly.
Where do you think that comes from? Was there alcoholism in your family?
Yeah. I'm reading a book right now called Codependent No More. Yeah. Yeah.
Identifying with it?
Yeah. I mean, yes, I am. I am. I'm like probably the most codependent person now that I'm realizing. And it's interesting to go through it because to start to realize this now, because I have two kids and I certainly don't want to, you know, I pass any of that on, because I think my mom, I'm sure I got a lot of it from my mom as well. There's, definitely alcoholism in my family and mental illness. So like there's a lot of, I think I was like I'm the oldest and the only girl. I think there's a lot of,
how many kids?
Three. I have two younger brothers. And I think, there's a lot of tap dancing on my part. Talking about like the comedian on the stage. Yeah. A lot of tap dancing. A lot of like trying to keep all the plates in the air for everybody.
If I can keep the silence, the uncomfortable silence from happening.
Yeah.
We won't have to deal with the elephant shitting on the dinner table.
No, silence is
painful.
So like that's why there was a lot of, I mean, we had a great time. Like underneath it, it's so interesting now. Like I grew up in Cleveland, you know, normal, like suburban, adorable white wooden house, like so perfect from the outside. Like, went to the Catholic school up the street because it was like the cheapest private education probably. And also, again, there's like that community, like parents had the couples club they would do every Tuesday. Like, we all vacationed together. We all, like, you know, there's a group, you know, that went to Catholic school all the way through high school.
Yeah. Were your parents practicing Catholics?
I mean, like, socially practicing, yeah. You know, when I was growing up, it was more so because, and I think more so because it was like, again, like social, you know, like we fasted, but like for like, you know,
did you eat?
I could make it for 3 hours and I was like, oh, isn't that horrible? We had something, this is awful. Oh, when I think about it, we had something called Rice Bowl Fridays, in which the nuns would give us rice for lunch so we could feel what it was to be poor or to live in like a poor country, but we could yet put as much butter on it as we wanted or salt because we could just have that. I mean, it was so awful, awful. Like, you think about that now, it's like, what? Rice Bowl Fridays.
So did you do eight years?
More so. Like,
did you do high school too?
Yeah, high school too. I went to an all-girls Catholic high school. So it was like uniforms my whole life.
That's actually why I went to the public high school, because I had tired of.
Did you go to Catholic school?
Yeah, I did. But the Catholic high school has always kind of fascinated me, especially when it's all one sex.
Yes.
What are some snapshots that stand out in your mind?
Oh, a couple of great ones. Sister Deborah, our directress. What are some of those? My mom thought I was going to, I think, grow like 17 sizes in the 4 years. So I was always, I looked like a Hasidic. Like, my skirt was so long because I think she thought I was going to, that the other girls would run over and just like literally pull it off me. Like, just always pantsed. Always. I would always open up my locker and there would just be a dick, some sort of cutout dick to hit me in the face. Like, we were just gross girls. Like, we would, you know, there was like a little, you know, lake in the middle of the campus, and, you know, inevitably it would just be filled with people's like maxi pants and tampons. Like, awful, awful, awful. We learned, what else did we do? I mean, there's so much. Mrs. Gaddis was our biology teacher. What are some other snapshots? We did a production.
Is there anything you want to elaborate on those two people that you mentioned?
Sister Deborah was our directress. As I mentioned, I had been doing theater, just loosely, at the Cleveland Playhouse, which was like the, you know, downtown theater or whatever. So I had done a play called Sneakers. So I thought I was really had made it.
Cleveland Playhouse is a pretty big deal.
It was.
But it is.
It's not. The Cleveland Clinic has taken over like half of the theaters now, and it's like a parking lot. And they used to have this awesome rep company of like grown up just Cleveland actors that I worshipped. And then they started getting people from New York. And
Tom Hanks performed there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
at Cleveland Playhouse.
Exactly. Paul Newman. Like a lot. Yeah, exactly. A lot of people. And it's the most beautiful theater. It was. The old theater was like. Yeah. You know, those little, like, in my mind, and like the dream theater in my head, it was like this little tiny proscenium, like all brick with like a ghost light just on the stage. And it was like, you know, that smell. Yeah. I loved it.
So,
Sister Deborah, she directed us in a production of, we did Annie, my freshman year, in which I played Annie with a clown wig on, just a red clown wig on, and my friend's Laura Ashley dress. And her Sister Deborah's dentist played Daddy Warbucks. He was the only gentleman in the cast. And as my mother would say, it was worse than what canal listening to that man try to screech his way through tomorrow. That was my mom's assessment. We did Wizard of Oz. I played the Tin Man. I think I had, you know, funnel on my head. And then we did, of course, Godspell, an all-female version of Godspell, where I played probably Judas or the slut. I can't remember her name. Who tempts Jesus, who was my friend Bernadette. So it was a kind of a awesome lesbian undertones, which I'm sure Sister Deborah was so excited by.
It was Sister Deborah a closet lesbian?
Yes, I'm sure.
And
it must have been it's so funny. Like we were, I can't even remember the order. Like who, cause you know how there's my brother went to my brothers went to St. Ignatius, which was the brother school, and they were taught by, I can't remember the great Jesuits.
Mm-hmm.
They're like the really good educators, apparently. Apparently, Everybody thought they were like incredible educators, but we would always laugh because like his freshman year reading list was like Iacocca. like the Aya Koko biography, and we were like, why? So weird.
Wow.
Yeah, just like capitalism.
Yeah.
Right off the bat. Exactly. Cut your hair. So sad. It was so so homophobic and so, like, it's just so weird.
What do you remember emotionally from grade school and high school? What do you remember thinking or feeling about yourself or the people around you or your place in the world?
I mean, oh, I think I never felt in my skin. Like, I never felt like I was saying what I meant, if that makes any sense. I still feel like I have a hard time saying what I mean. Like, I think so much of me is still trying to, like, say what people want to hear. And that's an awful thing. Totally when you're a mom. Like, so all this stuff is coming up now because I'm thinking, like, I really want my kids to be able to say what they mean. As, like, easy as that sounds, like, for some reason for me, well, now, not for some reason, we probably know why, like, it was the hardest thing for me to do. It was, like, deflect, and I just wanted people on, it's not like I wanted people on my side, I wanted to be on their teams. Like, it was like, it was interesting. So I think that was definitely a way of, like, isolating myself, I think, because I didn't really have to get close to anybody. Nobody really knew who I was because I didn't know who I was. So it was like, I didn't really even have, like, very close friends. Do you know what I mean? I stayed a girl for a really long time. Like, my mom, of course, like, not enabled, in the sweetest way. Like, I remember being like 12, like a little too old, like buying doll stuff and keeping it under my bed. Like, it was my secret with my mom. So that I would, like, when I was in, like, early high school, I would want to, like, still be a kid. Like, the thought of growing up was terrifying to me. Like, terrifying. I didn't want to, like, you know, when your friends all of a sudden start, you know, wanted to go out on the weekend, I would be so torn as to, like, I would wanted to be home. Like, it was very hard. Like, I knew I had to, like, I knew if I did this, that meant I could get through, like, you know, socially in school, I would be covered. Like, it would go a long way but I would rather have been at home with my mom.
What do you think you were afraid of that was out there, or what was it that drew you to being home?
I mean, I think I was protecting my mom. I think I was afraid to leave her. And also, like, we had so many that we didn't even talk about. Our family had a lot of secrets. Like, and so we were trying on the outside to be this, like, totally normal, functioning family. And I think inside inside the house, we were anything but, and we knew it. And so I think there was always that push pull that we never talked about. But I remember seeing Blue Velvet in the opening of it, where they have the rock
and they pan down into the earth and you see all the bugs. I so related to that.
I saw that, and I was like, how did he get inside my mind?
Yeah. I knew exactly what he meant.
Totally. Yeah. That was like, that's what I felt like our child. It was like the most beautiful. Like, I'm telling you, you'd see my house and it was like, this perfect, like, my bedroom, like, was so girly, and it was like, it was like a dollhouse, and none of us could really handle, like, I think also, like, my parents, how do I say it in a way that's, like, respectful, because everybody's doing the best they can, God knows, but I feel like they definitely, my mom was more of a friend than a mom. So I felt like I had this, like, incredible responsibility to everybody, I think.
God, that's huge. That's huge.
It's exhausting, especially when you're that young. And I'm not saying, like, she's amazing and she's had, you know.
So many parents in that generation didn't know that their kids aren't supposed to be their best friend.
Yeah,
but
I know.
They didn't know that.
Right. She would send me cartons of cigarettes. Like, that was, like, our thing, was to, like, smoke together. I think of that. And all my friends used to be like, your mom's the coolest. Like, my freshman year of college. It's only now that I have two little kids, I'm like, wow, that is so interesting.
What do you think you would have liked to have said out loud in your family when you were a kid. If nobody's feelings would have been hurt.
I mean, probably would have said, like, I need a parent. Like, I can't take care of your feelings and try to figure out who I am at the same time. You know? Because I think that's what happened. Like, I think I was so caught. And that's not to say, like, she wasn't, but that either of them weren't, like, available and, but it definitely was, I think you're right. I think a lot of parents, it's that same, a lot of that generation is the same thing. Like where you're not quite sure. Like I read another book called, which has nothing to do with, but called, it was called like Covert Incest or something, which it has nothing to do with being with anything sexual. It's just that when the relationship is not, it's not a parent child. It's like, it's more complicated. Like the parent needs something from the child.
The parent's needs come ahead of the child's needs. That, yeah.
Or they're looking to, or where a parent is trying to have a substitute spouse in their child because their own partner is, they don't feel connected to that person or they don't. So I feel like that's really common.
And it's really, I don't want to sound over dramatic, but it's really, it leaves a lot of scars.
Yeah.
Scars certainly, well, scars make it sound like it's something that can't be healed, but it leaves a lot of, let's put it this way, kind of little cuts on your soul.
Yeah. But doesn't it take to growing up for even to like, or I mean, because I didn't even, I'm telling you, if you'd asked me at 18, I would have been like, I have the greatest family. Like, all I want to do is spend time with them. Like, how lucky are we that we want a vacation together? Like, how many mothers and daughters want to spend this time together? How many family units want to be together? Like, and you realize, like, there's a lot of other reasons behind that need to be together than just, are you so uncomfortable in that chair?
No, I'm totally comfortable.
Good, I'm glad.
I was just going to say that so often I hear people's stories and they're afraid to have compassion for themselves because what they experienced at the time didn't feel awful.
Right.
People that were sexually molested, maybe their body got some type of enjoyment out of it. People that were a best friend to a parent, there was a feeling of, you know, being involved.
Yes.
But as you get older, you realize that there were things that were supposed to form inside you that didn't get a chance to form, a recognizing of your needs, an inability to ask for your needs and be comfortable with it.
Oh, God. Exactly.
I think you and I are very alike in that we're terrified of looking selfish.
Yeah. Yeah. I really am. Like, I hear somebody say something positive about themselves, and I'm like, wow, I really wish I could, like, say that about myself. Like, I couldn't imagine it.
That's the biggest fear that I have is that people are talking about me and saying how selfish I am. I would rather die.
I'm telling you, me too. What is wrong? I mean, exactly. That is exactly. Yeah. The thought of other, and I remember having, like, I remember some therapist being, oh my God, that's fascinating. Not some therapist, my mother saying, what they think about you is none of your business. And I remember being like, that is an amazing thing to say that I will never feel.
It sounds like she's in some type of recovery. Is she in some type of recovery?
No.
Oh, because that's a...
I know. I don't know where she got that, but she said that was something that she said to me, and I was... I mean, she's like, yeah, I know. She's an amazing, amazing... But I mean, my family's so amazingly, like, screwed up. Like, whose isn't? I don't know. It's like... But we were having Christmas this year, I think, this year. For the first time, I'm not going to just let my family to Cleveland because it's too much and it's too expensive. And, you know, my poor kids think that Santa, everything is from Amazon because the only way I can, like, ship toys is to, like, go through Amazon. So, like, under the tree, there's just, like a sea of that blue wrapping paper with, like, bad tags. So, anyway, everybody's coming here this year. But I'm telling you, it's my mom, my brother, and my dad. They've been divorced for, I can't tell you how long, they're all coming here. I mean, amazing.
Are you stressed or are you happy?
No, I think it's going to be, I'm actually excited that it's I mean, in terms of like growth or whatever, like I feel like, okay, it's on our turf. Like I'm taking care of what my family needs. Still can't say what I need, but like what my family needs, you know, me and my kids and my hubby. It was what we, so I'm, and they were great. It was hard. The thought of asking them was harder. And then when they said, of course, I thought, well, what's wrong with me? And honestly, like, what's the worst that can happen if you just ask for what you want? You know what I mean? It's so stupid.
You can be ridiculed or told that you were selfish.
Right. Right.
You know?
Are you the type of person that lays in bed at night, like, worrying about what you said?
Oh, my God.
Me too.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that stupid? Don't you want all that time back?
Yeah, well, you know.
What do we do, Paul? I need to sleep.
Well, for me, I had to go to therapy and I have to go to support groups and because I need that feedback on an almost daily basis to be reminded that I have value, that I'm worth something, because there was just a lot of messages that were kind of pounded into my head, sometimes verbally, sometimes just by a lack of something,
yeah,
that makes me feel like I'm not, my needs aren't worthy, and to ask for them would be selfish,
yeah.
And that fear of that is, it's so deep.
And then you think, man, we're not young people, like, this is the time, what's the worst that can, like, when we are on the deathbed, it's just us, like.
Well, in my mind, the worst that happens is that person then goes tells everybody else, hey, did you hear what this selfish prick did?
I know.
What this selfish prick wants?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did your parents ever call you selfish? Was there?
I mean, yeah, I don't remember. Like, I mean, I definitely in high school, when that like pull away happens to every, you know, that's like a human being's path, like they have to, like, but it was so hard.
Was your mom resisting you pulling away?
Yeah.
Do you remember how she would resist it?
Well, she would get like sad, or, you know, she kept calling, like, it's always my little girl. Like, I'm never, like, I literally had a newborn in my arms and she was like, look at your little baby hands, about me. Like, I will always be her baby girl. You know, even though I feel like so much of the time now, I feel like I'm taking care of her.
Oh my God.
I know. It's intense.
It's crazy. And The thing that bothers me about, because I just recognize that my mom has been doing that my whole life, is she infantilizes me.
Yeah.
And she refers to me like an object. Mom's cutest, mom's sweetest, mom's little peachy rose.
Oh, God.
And as I read, and I believe that my mom's a borderline, and as I read about it.
Does she know that?
No. Okay. She has no idea. There's a sense of comfort that she gets from me remaining an object, because then I'm like a vessel,
right,
for her to get emotions that keep her afloat.
Right. Right.
Do you feel like that?
Yes. And I feel like if I don't grow up, then she doesn't grow up. You know what I mean? Like she's, if she can keep, because I think that it has got to be scary. Like I don't think you ever, I mean, because I, you know, at 39, I'm like, I still feel very much connected to, like, the 14 or 15-year-old girl. Like, I still, it's very hard for me to think that I'm, like, and I think every person thinks that they are singular in that feeling. Like, I think every adult walks around thinking, like, I have such a young spirit.
Yeah.
Like, I really feel like everybody, like, I just think that's, like, I'm sure that when I'm, like, I mean, I have flashes now of like, oh, that's a different, like, I, you know, all of a sudden it happened so fast. Like, I don't quite know where I'm going with this train of thought, but I remember like thinking the eighth graders were like, I would never be that big. Like, I would just never. And then all of a sudden it's like, time just goes faster and faster and faster. Like, I remember my mom turning 35 and being like, she is, wow, she's so old. I remember she cried on her 35th birthday. I have like a very specific memory because we took a Polaroid picture of all of us holding a sign saying, you're 35, happy birthday. And she was really offended.
Really?
She thought my dad had done it as a way of a jab at her being 35.
Were they divorced?
They were obviously not in like the greatest of marital state.
How old were you when they got divorced?
Old. I was like 29. I mean, it was a long time coming. Like, our lore, like the mythology of our family was that my parents met and got married 3 months later. And my mom always says it was because it was the first man that she had ever dated that had a college degree because he went to Notre Dame. And her part, like, I remember growing up with the story of, like, you know, I remember putting my flowers down on the altar thinking, this is a terrible mistake. Like, that was like what we had heard.
Would she say that in the presence of your
dad?
All
the time. They were like the Bickersons, but hilarious. Like, they were a great comedy team. Like, they were, I mean, because she has a great biting, like, I mean, she's hilarious. Like, her one line, she's hilarious. And, but they always, they were, so socially, they were amazing. Like, people loved having them over. They were, but they just never should have been together.
Was there ever, I'm just going to move your mic
please.
A tiny bit closer.
Okay.
Was there ever a sense of affection between them?
Yeah.
And intimacy?
Absolutely. And they came together like a lot of, you know, when they, I mean, you know, to be totally, I don't know what, I think they just kind of cohabitated after a while. Like, you know, when you feel like you're just trapped.
Yeah.
Okay. We're like, I like this, like my thoughts, like I can't, like, I literally can't sleep. Like, I just feel like I'm having a hard time. Like, sometimes I go these periods of like having a hard time relating to people because it's so trapped in my own.
And it feels almost false.
Yes.
To be talking about anything but that.
Yes. Or you get fixated on something, like, and my sweet husband, who's got like the patience of the saint, like he'll, you know, I'll get, even decisions are so hard for me because I'm afraid that I'm going to let the other person down. Whatever, it's, you know, what it is. But it's interesting. Like, I definitely think about it sometimes. Like, huh? And I haven't been to. I used to go to therapy all the time, and just my husband and I love couples therapy, even though like the first 20 minutes is usually us like figuring out schedule for the week with like the guy just kind of staring at us, the counting his money, and then we kind of get into it and then it's time to go. Yeah. But I've been to a hypnotherapist before, which was fascinating. But yeah, it would be great. I think I definitely should get in.
What was the hypnotherapist like?
You know, it's so funny, Paul, like I did not know it was going to be a hypnotherapist. Like I she was recommended when I was pregnant with my daughter, I had like a rough birth the first time around. And so I was like, I'm going to do it. This is going to be on my terms. Like, again, everything we've been talking about, like, I'm going to have my birth. I'm not going to say have a doctor, whatever. All that stuff that you think you're in control of, when in fact, that's like the first lesson of parenting is like, oh, literally completely out of my control. How this person is going to announce our arrival. But I went to this doula recommended this therapist who ended up being a hypnotherapist, and she was incredible. The first time was not successful. It was, I really tried hard. Like, I faked it, basically. I basically was like,
oh my God, you are such a people pleaser.
I know. Faked my own, like, hypnotherapy. Yeah. Like, I made up, I like told her what I thought she'd want me to see on the big dark staircase going down.
Yeah. Because that's less scary than having to confront that she might be ineffective,
and then
she might feel bad about herself.
Oh my god! Oh my god! Totally.
Gotta keep everybody from feeling bad about themselves.
Yes. Oh god, this is such a call to arms. This podcast today. Because it's true. It's going way too fast with this nonsense. I'm telling you, what did my son say the other day that I was like, uh-oh. Oh, his closest friend bit him on the nose. And he was so betrayed. My son was so, understandably betrayed by that. He was horrified. He couldn't believe that he would hurt him that way. It was more of a surprise. It was out of, the kid did it out of anger. He was so so hurt. And he cried very hard. And then Ethan, my husband, said that he had all of a sudden had turned it, and that he didn't want Will to not be his friend anymore. Like, he was afraid of pushing Will away by having such a strong reaction about being bit on the nose. I was like, oh my God, he's not even fucking six. Like, now's the time.
Yeah.
I do not want that. Like, I don't know how that's learned, because he probably sees me apologizing to everybody. You know?
I believe it can be learned, but, you know, when you talk about still feeling like you're 13 or 14, that is, I think, what happens in the absence of learning the tools that some other adults were either shown or got. And
right.
I relate to that so much. I mean, the feeling like when somebody would call you sir, I imagine when somebody calls you ma'am, sometimes you just want to go, you don't understand what a fucking child I am.
Yeah. Oh my God. Exactly.
I've been playing video games for 14 hours. I haven't showered. I am not a sir.
Exactly. Exactly. No, it's crazy. Like, I was living with a girlfriend because, you know, in some of those fashion magazines, they have, like, what looks good on, and then it says, like, 20-year-old, 30-year-old, 40-year-old, 50-year-old, 60-year-old. I'm like, I'm still looking at the 20, like, I'm still looking like the 20s. Like, I just, there's no business to be even seen in any of those clothes. But I immediately flip to the, like, it's just crazy. Yeah. Like, the 30 already looks like a little, like, dowdy and matronly. And it's like, oh my God, I'm like, I'm going to be 40. It's so weird. It's so weird.
What are some common negative thoughts that you have towards yourself?
I sound like I'm such bad news on this. Here are some negative thoughts. You know, the basic. Like, not pretty enough. Not, you know, should have got that nose job when I had the chance. It's way too late now. Although it would be amazing if it was all of a sudden I was like, just, hey. God. Not in, I still don't feel like I'm, you know, it's a rare is the time that I'm like, I've nailed it. You know, I wish.
A job, you mean?
Yeah.
A performance.
Or like, yeah, like a gig, like something. I still feel like I'm, wish I was a better actor.
Forget about the fact that your IMDb list is gigantic. You've got three.
We're nuts,
projects.
Though.
I just looked at it last night. You've got three projects that are in post-production right now. That's as busy as people get.
I know, and you just never, but I mean, like, there's, and all of it. Like, I feel like I'm not, of course, like, not funny enough. Like, I'm not, you know, or that I'm not invested enough as a mother. Like, you know, what are some negative thoughts? Oh my God, honey, I could go on and on and on. So sometimes I feel like I wish I was more sincere. Like, I wish that I, like, it all goes back to the thing we said at the beginning. Like, I wish I was said what I meant and felt okay with it. You know?
Can you think of any times that you were insincere and what you would have liked to have sincerely said in your life?
Oh. Yeah. I mean, there's so many times. I mean, there's, yeah. I mean,
can you give me any examples?
Here's like a professional, like a business one. Like, I wish that I had been able to tell a very important TV network exactly what I thought of the pilot, instead of just feeling like I had to just smother fake, like, yeah, it's great. And then, because then maybe I could have not done it, or it would have been better. Do you know what I mean? If I had trusted my voice, if I trusted, like, what I had thought.
What would you have said if you...
I mean, like, why does everything need to be underscored? Like, why does there need to sound like there's a four-piece band behind everything that we do? Like, why can't you just trust the joke? Like, why do you have to have the dumb sound effects? Like, I hate I hate when music is put behind scenes, because it's like, you don't
Me
trust
too.
It.
Yeah. It's so condescending.
So condescending. I wish, you know, there's been plenty of times I wish I had had the balls to ask for one more take at the risk of offending the crew, you know, for just the betterment of the thing as a whole. I wish, you know, I've been in the position of being like this, you know, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth banana to like the lead. And so much of my energy is making that person feel beautiful, hilarious, funny, perfect. And I so sometimes wish because I feel like sometimes I sometimes wish I had been able to, you know, who am I, like, not to tell them what I think of what they're doing. Like, that's not my business. But just, I don't know. I guess, like, not try so hard. Like, what, who cares? Because it's not like we are talking now. You know what I mean? It's not like we forged this friendship that lasted. Like, I don't know. It's like wasted energy. Like, I feel like there's a lot of wasted energy. I mean, I wish in my life I was able to do that with friends. Like, I wish I had the guts to just say goodbye to friendships that are not healthy. Yeah. Instead of this weird dragging along, which is not fair to anybody. It's not fair to them because they're like, you know. I wish I could say what I meant to somebody and then not feel like I had to take care of the person's feelings after it. I'm bad at confrontation. Like, I wait. It's like the codependent, like City. You wait until too much builds up and then you let it out and then it's like the wrong time.
And the words are poorly chosen. Totally. And the intensity is way off the charts.
It's so stupid. I know. Now, thank God I have the most patient husband in the world. It's gonna sound like a real catch in this particular podcast. I really do. I really do. Who wants to sign up? Oh, God. They're going to be lining up.
You are like so many people, Catherine. You it's, I think your honesty is so awesome, and I think that's the most attractive thing in other people is the ability to laugh at the things about ourselves that we wish were different.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to hide them.
Yeah, yeah. Ay, ay, ay. Yeah.
You know, going back to the thing about talking to the, you know, the star, making them feel funny and beautiful and all that other stuff. I was picturing that in my head and picturing what it would be like if you didn't say those things to those people. And is it that silence would kill you to just be there silently waiting for the camera to roll?
Yes. Yes. Because it's not my business. I'm not going to say I know how to do it better. Or it's not like I know I should be the one direct. Like, none of that. Although sometimes I feel that way. I'm sure you do too. Like, you know, there's plenty of things where you're like, oh. But I don't know why I need to fill that with. Because then I think so much of it, like, you lose your power. Like, you lose your own power if you diffuse it, you know. If you give it away, if you give something away that's not true, then you just feel like there's been so many, like, I remember doing projects where, like, the vibe on the set was not great or what. So I felt like I was, tap dancing for the crew, for everybody, to make everybody have it. Because I don't like, there's a lot of people that like working in tension. Like, I just can't. Like, I don't know how you get good work that way. Like, I don't know how the product is going to be better if people are scared. Like, I just feel like if the loose around it, it's not to like fuck around while the camera's not rolling, but I do feel like some of that is really valuable because it helps everybody just open up and feel safe, and you just got to jump off, you know. I love that feeling. When everybody's like, everybody, crew, everybody is, you know, there's nothing, there's the worst feeling is when you feel like you're separated from the camera for the crew. Because we're all, again, like, it's that feeling we're all in it together. Like, you know, then you just think you're doing something so dead. Like, and it just is heavy and light, like, I hate that feeling. So, yeah, I guess so much of the, I did one thing I remember where I was like the worst vibe and I spent so much time taking care of everybody's feelings that then when it was time for me, you know, to be on camera, I had no idea what I was doing. I was like atrocious. Cause I just like had not spent any energy on the work that I was supposed to be doing. It was like a dumb rookie move. Like I just did not spend time on my business, what I was supposed to be doing.
I've mentioned this analogy before, but I love it so much. I can't remember who it was that told me about it, but they use the analogy of when you're flying, if there's an emergency in an airplane and you're with a child, what they tell you to do is put your mask on first, because otherwise you're of no use to those around you if you don't take care of yourself first.
Isn't that an awesome? I know. Yeah. I know. It's so, yeah, exactly. And like, I know, like, I'm a good person. I know I'm a kind person. I know I'm a decent human being. The thing I'm most proud of, I think, is my kids are decent people. Like, I think they both have good, it's so tricky. I want them to be empathetic, but not to lose themselves. You know what I mean? It's like a hard thing because where am I even going with this? It's a weird, I don't know where I was going with that, Paul, to be honest.
Do you trust that they'll get there on their own? Not that you need to be absent, but that you don't need to micromanage.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're not like, it's so interesting. Like I thought I was going to be much more, but I'm not. Like
I just realized what a stupid question that is.
No,
like you would say, yes, Paul, I'm going to need to micromanage their lives.
I actually did an interview once with someone like, are you like a hands-on mother? I was like, what if I said I was a hands-off mother? Like, how good would that be? I was like, no, I would call myself hands-off.
I find them to be a little tiring. I'm the one that needs
to nap. I haven't seen them in years. I farmed them out. But they are, I mean, it's weird. Like, I thought I was going to be much more. Maybe it's because of how, I don't know. Like, you know, for all of like our codependence, like growing up, like we really like, you know, I'm sure you did this too. Like I got home from school. My parents didn't see me until dinner. And then we just had so much freedom. Like we didn't have classes. Like we didn't have crap after school. We didn't have childhood needs to, like someone said that to me. They're like, childhood needs to breathe. And I was like, it does. Like you just in that, when you find, like, do you remember going so deep into pretend, like playing
so
pretend?
Oh yeah.
And I can see it now happening with them. And like, you don't want to interrupt it because it's like the most beautiful thing like that.
And so many kids, their lives are so highly structured because their parents are afraid their kids aren't going to be successful. If they don't achieve and you know, hop enough hurdles. And yet they need to be kids. They need to, they need that free time to be creative and to experiment and I think to make mistakes and learn from their mistakes,
Absolutely.
Not be protected from making mistakes.
I know. That's the hard thing. But you're right. Like, he has to get hurt. Like, they both have to fall down. They have to fall in love and get their hearts broken.
I could help.
I can
sit them down and I can go through their flaws once a week
if you could do one of these podcasts with my 6-year-old.
Yeah.
I think it would be fascinating. Or you could just really quickly just rip a Band-Aid off of his knee and slap him. That's fine.
So you're not currently in any kind of therapy?
No. But I have to be. I mean, I feel like it would be. It's been a. I should be. I really should. I know. I don't know what's wrong. I feel like maybe it's because I just haven't been around. So like any free time I have, I feel like I want to be here, you know. I feel like there are a lot of codependent human beings.
I agree.
Especially maybe in this line of work, because we're so dependent on other people's feelings.
And we grew up being performers.
Yes.
What do I need? What does this situation need?
Right.
Which is what a scene is what does this situation need?
What do I want? What am I going to do to get what I want?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's much easier to play a selfish character than to venture into asking for your own needs. I think that's why dislikable characters are so much fun to play.
I love it. I know. Me too. I agree. I love it because I love being in a person that says exactly what they want to say at all times. Like, I feel really, and I feel like I can do it. Like, I love the feeling of it. I love being in like an uninhibited space.
Describe for me like a dream moment. If there weren't repercussions and people's feelings wouldn't get hurt, give me some moments of how you'd like to carry yourself.
Like, I'd love to be able to like look people in the eye. Stand up straight. I really haven't even perfected the art of just standing up straight. Like owning my space, like taking space and being okay.
Instead of
with
having
space.
An apologetic posture.
Yeah, my last doctor called it the Hamburglar. Like I'd walk around like, hey, like. And like, it's like, she was like, here comes Han the Hamburglar. Cause I was like, couldn't even just stand up.
She's
like,
kind of crouching over
yes,
her right now.
Like just and, own yeah. being like a woman, a mother, just being okay with being, cause I am okay with being my age. Like I actually feel like I've earned it. Like I feel actually, I feel better than I have. Like I feel closer to who I am now than I did actually. But I think I'd love to be able to just take my space and have confidence. Like I would love to be able to have more confidence. And it's tricky because a part of me, like, you know, we're astute enough people to know that having that lack of confidence is helpful, right? I think it's helpful. Like I have to believe that when you feel satisfied, it takes away something hunger wise or
I would disagree.
Drive-wise. Please tell me.
I think your love of the craft is not going to disappear if you get confidence.
Yeah.
In fact, if anything, it'll give you more, this sounds such a pretentious way of saying it, more colors in your palette to paint as an actor because you will have lived that experience and you will know, or maybe you can picture it and you can play that.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it when I've worked on myself, it has never made me not want to be creative. It's just made what I want to create different.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people use that as an excuse, because they're afraid to go deep down into the icky and to have to deal with that. And it's easier to say, well, this kind of drives me, you know, this insecurity. It drives me, but the side effects, it's like one of those pills that they advertise where, you know, the last 10 minutes of the ad are all these side effects. Yes. So yeah, maybe you get a hard on from it, but you know.
Yeah, but you could literally, you're just going to have nothing but diarrhea for right. a year.
I mean, that's my take. Yeah. I'm certainly no expert.
I hear you, Paul. On this. But then it's like, it's so interesting. Like I heard somebody talk about something they did. So confidently, and again, all I heard was that it was being cocky or humility. And then I was like, this is such a weird thing because it does take this business, because it does take a specific bird to be able to sell what they've made, pitch, whatever, the verb, again, such a grandma, in front of a group of people, trust it. And then, like, what do you do then if it is not received in the way that you, that's just life. But like, so my go-to hit forever is if I underplay, then I don't have much to lose if and when they don't dig it, which is awful way to think, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like an awful way to like short change yourself. If you're like, you know, it's all right.
If I don't risk by putting energy out, then I won't be hurt as badly. I think that's pretty normal.
Yeah.
To feel that way. I certainly relate totally to that. But getting back to the point about the confidence thing, I think the myth there is that confidence and humility exclude each other. But
right.
I don't think at all.
No, I don't think they need to either. I know.
But in our heads, in our insecure heads, we're so afraid of even coming close to the line.
I know.
Of where confidence goes into cocky.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. I know.
That we stay 100 yards back going, oh, no, you first. You first.
Yeah.
You first. You first.
Yeah. Like, I'd rather do that than take my place in line. I know.
But then we miss, I think we miss out on things.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when we're trying to fill that silence, we're afraid of something. Maybe that person's going to say something that we're tap dancing over that.
Yes.
That person. Maybe there's something we need to hear.
Exactly.
If you listen to probably the first 15 episodes of this podcast, it's hard to listen to because I steamroll people.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'll get emails from people that are like furious at me. But now they're saying, oh, it's nice. You're not doing it as much. But I didn't even realize I was doing that until I started editing it. I started getting those emails. I'm sure I did it a couple of times in our interview here today. But the point is,
I didn't feel that.
When I first started in the interview, letting there be more silence, it felt so incredibly awkward. Yes. It felt so weird. And now I'm getting more comfortable with it. And in that space, I'm getting things from listeners that I, or from guests that I wouldn't have gotten if I had been tap dancing in that,
right,
in that silence. But it does feel weird at first. And I think the point I want to make is just because it feels weird at first doesn't mean it's not good.
Right.
It's just our old coping skill freaking out.
It's freaking
on us.
Out. It's so true, because even if you were, I mean, even to start thinking of any kind of improvised scene, if you let it sit for a second, you know, that's where the surprise, it deepens, and that's where the surprise comes.
And it's like its own natural rhythm just appears.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to force a rhythm on it because you're afraid it's going to fail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Paul, that confidence and humility thing I'm going to be thinking about a lot. Because I know we both, I mean, I don't know if you do, but I know, I'm assuming that we must have a fair amount of confidence in us.
Yeah.
Some, right? We're confident.
Yeah, to be
people.
Performers.
Yes.
To
right.
get in front of a room full of people and say, right. here's the choice I made about this script, and I think it's worthy of you watching.
Right.
Yeah, that takes yeah. certainly confidence.
Right.
And you will always be able, I think, to access those things should you want them. That feeling of, oh, I got to get this done. I got to get that done. That will always be there.
Yeah.
But getting some confidence will allow another choice to be there should you want that choice. And I cooked a lot of chicken and showed a lot of movies. So I see how I got to put myself down there because I'm afraid.
Yeah,
I'm
you did. That was a like, total reason.
Afraid I'm going to sound like a know-it-all. I got to kick.
That deflect.
I got to kick me before the listener gets a chance to.
That's, totally. Yeah, totally. It is a fake fart. So maybe that'll negate everything that was said in this conversation.
Do you normally I go out on the show with we trade loves, things that we love.
Yes.
Would you like to
improvise
some of those?
Yes. We trade back and forth?
Yes,
we
trade
God,
back
I'm so
and
excited.
Forth.
Okay, good. You have a list?
I do. I'm gonna be reading some listeners. I'm actually gonna improvise some of my own until I feel like I've run out.
Okay.
And then
it can
I'll
be anything.
Cheat. It can
right?
be anything.
Okay.
But, you know, I think the less run of the mill, the better. You know,
right.
like, I love my children. Everybody knows that.
Right.
Everybody knows you don't
but
love
I
your
don't
children.
Love my
yes.
children. Right.
Everybody.
So that would
see
be a
that.
Lie.
You let them dry on the fucking couch. I mean,
they're sitting in the car right now yeah. with the windows up.
So
we can have some privacy.
So.
I love a grilled peach on like in June. Outside, after just having like hot dogs and some rosé, I like grilling a peach with some vanilla ice cream and eating it outside.
Now that does sound good.
Mm-hmm.
I love walking into my favorite coffee place and having some of the regular customers say hi, having some of the staff say hi, and feeling like there's a place in the world that I belong.
I love picking up my daughter from preschool and seeing her, being able to see her in her little circle with the other kids for a second before she's noticed me, and see, and always surprised by what a beautiful autonomous person she is. And then when she sees me in her face, the look on her face, like I feel like my heart's gonna jump out of my chest. I just feel like I'm gonna turn into a puddle. And then vapor just float into the sky.
That's beautiful. I love when I get a hot fudge sundae and they also have marshmallow sauce, and I get both put on, and there is enough of both, because I would say 95% of the time they don't give me enough, and I got one on Catalina Island a couple of weeks ago, and there was enough of both. It was the perfect amount of marshmallow sauce and hot fudge sauce, and I was like, this is the fucking greatest.
That sounds unbelievable. Yeah. I love Ohio in the fall. I love the smell of burning leaves. I love when the sky gets darker earlier at night. I love all things Halloween. I love putting on sweaters.
I love snorkeling and that moment when the waves kind of start to move you a little bit too close to the rocks and it gets a little scary and then you paddle away. And I just love that. I just love that experience of feeling like you're improvising with the ocean. Like the ocean has this power and you're kind of almost flirting with its power, but you're respecting it.
Jesus. I love a road trip. I love when it's the four of us in one car with a suitcase, where everything, I feel like everything I need in the whole world is in the smallest little, you know, metal machine. I love putting my feet up on the dashboard and just listening to dumb music really loud with them.
I totally relate to that, because I think what I love about when you take a road trip and all your stuff is in one suitcase is you feel like you've simplified your life. And all the chaos and all the loose ends and all that stuff, you've given yourself permission for 48 hours or whatever to just boil it down to this, and you're just gonna
love it.
Not question that, oh, I should be in the living room doing this. I should be
totally.
Yeah.
When you have like a toiletry bag, like there's nothing more satisfying. This might feel like my OCD, but I love like a clean drawer. I love opening a drawer and being like, ah, oh, everything has its place. Yeah. She was a Montessori kid, so maybe that's why I breathe.
I love that we've talked for over an hour. And we didn't even touch on your OCD.
Yeah, we didn't even touch on
so,
and then until next time.
So I'm going to have you back.
Fine.
Catherine, thank
this
you.
This was heaven.
Oh,
I feel like I
you.
Should now write a check to you, though, for your therapy services.
Well, I feel the same way.
Okay,
so
good.
we'll just call it a draw.
As it were.
Thank you
so much. This was worth the wait.
Yeah. Was there anything that you wanted to plug?
No.
Okay.
Except my
God, no.
You mouth might, hole.
You might appear selfish.
Except my butthole. I can't stop farting. No, right. But thank you.
Many thanks to Catherine Hahn for a great episode. I really, really enjoyed interviewing her. Before I take it out with a couple of... one survey and one email from a listener... I want to remind you guys, the website for my friend's towel, the bamboo towel, is getzhu.com, getzhu.com. And you can support our show non-financially by going to iTunes and giving us a good rating. That boosts our ranking, brings more people to the show, And you can also support it by spreading the word on social media. That's always greatly appreciated. All right, enough of my yakking. I am going to read a survey that was filled out. This is from the Shame and Secret survey. This was filled out by a woman who calls herself Frida. She's straight, but qualifies it. She says, but I have a big crush on a lesbian friend. Frida's in her 40s, was raised in an environment that was pretty dysfunctional. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? She writes, some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts as sexual abuse. I've blocked out many childhood memories, but a neighborhood man would fondle his daughter, my friend, in front of me and showed himself. I'd say that's sexual abuse. Also, it seemed like I was constantly attracting crazy older men. While walking down the street with my friend, a man pulled over his car, opened the door, leaned out, and started jacking off. Same thing in the library, in the hardware store. These times I was with my parents and they didn't do anything. I don't know what's more alarming, these guys hanging out of the car, whacking it, or in the library or the hardware store, or your parents not doing anything. How could that not fuck up your opinion of men? You know, one of those things happening, I would think would make men scary. Deepest, darkest thought, she writes, that after 12 years of misery and dragging my mom down, my sick father would finally die so that she could have a little life before her Alzheimer's totally consumes her. What sexual fantasies are most powerful to you? She writes, I don't have any. I struggle for them, actually, because I'd like to like sex, but sex makes me embarrassed. It makes me feel stupid, all that emoting and physical pleasure. But sometimes I play the role, the perfect sex partner, and hate every moment of it. It's like living outside my body. That makes me so sad, and yet that is such a common thing that I read in the Shame and Secrets survey. There are so many people, there are some men that feel that way too, but it mostly seems to be women who were sexually abused, and they feel like it's a shortcoming of theirs that they're this way, and they blame themselves. Continue on with what you wrote. What are your deepest, darkest secrets? She writes, when I was about 10, my father got up in the middle of the night with his rifle. And I'm sorry this is so dark, but this is, you know, this is the show. And I sometimes will save the darker stuff for the end so that if it's too dark for you, you can just turn it off and you won't miss the rest of the show. Father got up in the middle of the night and went to the garage to kill himself. My mom stopped him, got the gun, and put it in under the covers in bed with me to keep it from him. When I told my mom about this memory, I was an adult before her Alzheimer's, she said, well, it wasn't loaded. My sister said the same thing when I told her. It wasn't loaded. As a young adult, my brother hit on me when we were really drunk in the hot tub, and I fell for it. This secret I will die with. Won't even tell a therapist. I watched my dad beat my older sister many times, and no one helped her. He beat me too, but not as bad because I tried really hard to be the good girl. I learned from my sister not to fuck up. I married young, 22, to a wonderful man who rescued me from my crazy home. He loved me deeply. I screwed around on him many, many times. I was horrible, and he just kept on loving me until one day he couldn't anymore. After 17 years, he finally had an affair himself, and I never took full responsibility for the failure of our marriage. I hate my father. I want to love him and be compassionate. He's horribly sick, but I am repulsed by him. He acts like he was a great father, but he hated us. We were never good enough or smart enough. He went back to college to get his law degree with 4 young children at home, but he never supported us going to college. He never told me he loved me until I spent a month in the hospital with him this year. Now me and my siblings, show up to take care of him like he's some great patriarch. We still pretend. I want to tell him how fucked he was as a dad, but I'm afraid it would kill him. Do these secrets and thoughts generate any particular feelings towards yourself? She writes, I feel guilty, like I need to, quote, just get over my childhood. Oh my God, that is why I wanted to read this survey. Frida, any person that is hearing me reading your survey is thinking to themselves,
you cannot just get over that kind of stuff happening to you. No human being could just get over that. She continues, I feel burdened like I will always be fucked up. I beat myself up for not being able to forgive my dad. I'm pissed because everyone around me acts like he's some great guy and is amazed by his will to live. I feel crazy because I want to scream that his will to live is just another play to control us all. Just want to give you a big hug, Frida. I just want to give you a big hug. And encourage you to tell your therapist everything. I tell my therapist everything, and it opens the doors for them to help you. It opens way more doors for them to help you. They are not there to judge you. They are not there to judge you. And I want to wrap this up with an email I got from a woman who just wants me to refer to her by her first initial, so I'll call her H. And she writes, there have been a few times where I've started to take a survey but never completed it. I've been compelled to email you about certain episodes, particularly to compliment you on a certain show, especially the one dedicated to the listeners. I'm plugged into my iPod listening to Cara Santa Maria, and I've found my topic where I can chime in. Mothers who deal with depression. Here's a quick picture. Mother of four kids. 13-year-old boy, 10, 8, and 6-year-old girls. All great kids. Really, they are. I fight depression and anxiety daily, and I take Effexor. From the perspectives of others in my community, I've got it all together, but I don't. I fight this every day. To make things more interesting, my husband of 15 years is in Afghanistan and has been deployed for about 6 months now. So it's me, four kids, our pets, our house, their homework, their schedules, bills, responsibilities, laundry, dishes, trash goes out, oil changes, lawn mowing, etc. It's totally overwhelming some days. Even today, during the show, you and Kara were talking about not wanting to get out of bed or wearing the same clothes for 3 days, not wanting to do the dishes in the sink. I claim it's because I simply don't have enough hours in the day, but the truth is, I don't really care. It'll be there. Who cares? So every day, I try. I don't think my kids would know I fight this. I really try to pull it off and keep it together in front of them. I wonder if my son would agree. I wonder if he sees right through it. She has in parentheses tears now. What kills me is that through all of this is that people don't understand, and I want them to. Example, parents of two kids, both parents home every night, and then I hear them complain about how much they have to do. Really? Don't come to me and bitch. It's just me. It's just me. I have no backup plan. No go-to person, no one to comfort me at night and hug away my fears. On top of all of that, I worry that the love of my life won't return from his deployment. There's so much on my plate that I can't even get past it. Well, my point was to just acknowledge that you are correct. Being a parent dealing with depression and anxiety is a tough thing. When I listen to your show, it makes me feel that I'm not alone. Thank you for producing this show and exposing people to the realities that many of us face. Thank you. And I'll read you what I wrote back to her. H, I'm so glad you wrote me. Your email really touched me. I started to write you a different email. I started to suggest talking to your doctor and seeing about tweaking your meds. I started to suggest a support group for spouses of soldiers. I started to suggest going to the forum and post on a thread that I started for moms. And then I thought, what you might need is just a big fucking hug across the internet. So imagine all the people out there who are just like you and me, who cry by ourselves and try to put on a brave face, whose brains are flooded with dark thoughts that we quickly brush aside but don't really get relief from because they just make us feel broken or weird or weak. Think about all the people who wake up and immediately think, I can't do this. I can't do this again. I'm too tired. Why me? I wish I had died in my sleep. Think about all of us holding your hand, hugging you, crying with you, and laughing with you about how much we cry and in what ridiculous places we start to cry and over the strangest things. Not being able to find a parking place, getting disconnected while on hold,
spilling food, not being able to find a pen. Just focus on today, this hour, this minute. Do what is right in front of you. Let go of the results. It's okay if we make mistakes. Fuck perfect. Perfect is an illusion that degrades our chance for serenity. Trying is enough. Don't worry about tomorrow, because we can't live tomorrow today, and who knows what it will bring. Most of all, keep reaching out. Keep talking about what you're feeling so it doesn't build up. Find people who understand and are safe to talk to, and let them help you. Let them be amazing friends or therapists or support group members. Most people want the chance to be amazing and supportive and helpful, but when you isolate, you deny them that opportunity and you let your feelings overwhelm you. There are millions of us who feel overwhelmed. You are one of many. The longer I'm alive, the more people I meet, the more I think that we are what normal is. You are not alone. You are not even close.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
Everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully Everybody fucked up in some weird way.